Now, hang on a minute. I've got to put my earphones into this because I put it into the laptop. Bear with. Oh, gosh, where? Oh.
We were all so excited to see your home studio and seeing how that was all going to pan out and see if you could up our quality. But actually, I think we're all on the even playing field here.
Yeah, I'm in my little alcove with sponge tiles.
John, good morning. Thanks for joining.
Good morning.
Morning.
How are we?
Fine, thank you. How are you guys?
We're good. I think we should go for an introduction. So, hi, Flick. I know you. So, this is Mark. This was my CSM on the show that I was just in.
Hello, Mark.
And then if Flick could introduce us to your friend, John, because we've not met John before.
Oh, yes. This is my best friend, John Oswald Leston, a fine actor and singer. We've known each other for how many years, John?
Probably longer than certainly one person on this podcast has been alive.
I've actually got shirts older than Tash.
I'll take it. So thank you so much for coming on this morning. You are our first actor duos, which is very, very exciting. Mark has the funniest question, which I think trumps any questions that I ever wanted to start with, and I just want to get to the nitty gritty of it to begin with, because I think it's hilarious. So go ahead, Mark.
Now, look, you're making it sound like we planned this stuff. We absolutely don't, because
there's
no planning. We come on about 3 minutes before guests join and go, so how do you know this person? I don't know. We'll just ask them. But so I said to Tash, this is very exciting that we've got actor brothers and sisters joining us. I'm going to ask them the killer question. Why acting and not stage management?
Oh, that's a really good question.
No, it's a terrible question, John, but it just makes me smile at the thought of it, because we are always asked, so do you not want to act? No.
Yeah, well, I was an ASM. I'm sure you were, John, at some point.
No, I've never been an ASM. I've only ever been an actor. Maybe you did other things, but I've only ever been an actor. So that's something I didn't know about you.
I did to get weeks on my card. That's what you had to do then in the old days.
Yes.
I had to get something like 46 weeks work. And so to get that, I did an ASM understudy job. And it was really hard because as the tour went on, it was something like, I think it was only about a 6-month tour actually. But it was just that checklist. Oh my goodness, that checklist. I just felt that it wasn't up my street, really. I tried my very best. I had a very strange thing happened in Bath Theatre Royal, where I'd set all the props on the stage, and somebody hid them. Yeah, they hid them behind the pros arch, the proscenium, sorry. And I couldn't find them anywhere, so I had to get new props from the wardrobe. It's a bit haunted, the Bath Theatre Royal. I think they were sort of doing the thing about it was the ghost that did it, you know, playing a trick on a young, innocent person like myself, as I was the same age as Tash probably then.
Well, worse, of course, playing a trick on the acting ASM, because it is one of those things, isn't it? It used to be a rite of passage, and now it's just cheapskate management, it seems. You never really, thankfully, see that post that often anymore at acting ASMs. And I always feel very, when I've ever had acting ASMs, I've always been very protective of them, because it's like you shouldn't be expected to do that props check, and why would you know it's not been something you've been trained to do? But you're always going to furiously be understudying and constantly, you know, trying to learn a script. It's always seemed a terribly mean job to me.
Yes. I mean, I think it was obviously, I was so delighted to just have the job. I had very, very scary company manager. Sorry, Mark, but I did have a very scary one. Are you ever scary?
No, I'm terrible at scary. I'm terrible at company managing, Tash will tell you. I'm much happier pushing scenery around on stage and letting Tash do props.
I absolutely disagree, but I do think Mark is one of the nicer company managers that you could come across.
I always think company managing is probably the hardest job to do, because you have to be everybody's friend. You have to be on the side of the actors, if we must talk about sides, but you have to be on the side of the actors. You have to be on the side of the stage management. You somewhat have to be on the side of the management and the producers themselves. It's a really hard road to tread. And if you have a brilliant company manager, they make your job everybody's job so much easier. But I think it's a very, it's a job that requires a lot of politics, I would imagine.
Mm.
Yeah, I have to be honest now. I don't actually like company managing very much, if we're being honest. And I don't actually think of myself as a company manager. I think of myself as a stage manager, but I'm just old and fat and they keep giving me the paychecks. And actually, you don't often now see company managers, of course. You see company stage managers, you know, two jobs for the price of one done badly, yeah. You know. So I tend, my CSMing tends to gravitate to just being on the stage as much as I can and then getting across with ticket requests and PR events and
Yes. After show chats.
After show. Now, I love after show chats, but there's now. We've got actors in the room. Let's ask the question. As a company stage manager, I'll say, folks, there's a Q&A post show. Would you be up for it? And everyone universally goes, oh, do we have to?
I love after show chats.
Yeah, I don't mind them. Cool.
It's so interesting. Some people come up with the craziest of questions for you guys.
Yes, they do.
And also, if they've paid money to see a piece of theatre and they've been engaged with that piece of theatre enough to wait afterwards, when they've also probably paid £25 in the bar in the interval for a really crap glass of wine, I think the least you can do is actually give them half an hour of your time and further the kind of dialogue on the conversation, because that's what theatre's about. I know that sounds a bit weird maybe, but I love after show chats. I really do.
Mm. It also gives a chance for the audience to see you for you. They've just watched you perform for an hour or two. They probably created this image of what you might be like, whether it's the villain or the hero or whatever. And then they hear you speak and they go, oh, he didn't have that accent. He really is Brummy. Oh, okay. All righty. Do you know what I mean? It's nice to see you for you.
I think what I like as well is I think after show chats are often a way to educate the audience about what it's like to be a theatre actor. When I've done it quite a few times, when I've done post show chats, and I worked quite a number of years in North America as well, and this used to happen more in North America than it happened here, but people would ask questions like, so what do you do when you're not doing this? Or is this your only job? Is this your real job? How much do you get paid? And they would often think that it was a bit like doing AmDram, or as they say in North America, community theatre. And they would be amazed that actually, no, this is what I've done for 30 years. This is my main or only job. Because still so many people assume that, if you're not on TV or you're not a household name, you can't possibly be an actor. So that's another reason I like after show chats, because I think it does, particularly for younger people, it makes them realise that there are lots of ways in the industry to be an actor.
That's interesting. You've had that experience in America, where they are going to be, I suspect, much more forthright with their questions and much less British reserved. Because, I mean, here we tend to get an awful lot of, oh, how do you learn your lines?
Yes.
And they're pretty uninspiring questions quite often.
In North America, they always seem to want to know straight away how much you paid.
Do you actually tell them, John?
Well, in North America, of course, it's different, because if people want to know how much you're paid, because it's a unionized industry, they can just look on the Actors Equity website and they can see how much you're going to be paid, because it's all set out by the union. Mm. But I think they're always surprised at, sometimes they're surprised at how much you've been paid. Sometimes they're surprised at how little you've been paid. The kind of how little you've been paid tends to happen in the UK. The how much you might have been paid tends to happen in North America, because pay is much better there.
Mm. Oh, considerably much better there, of course, isn't it? And which is why, we have brother stage managers in Broadway that have second homes in the Hamptons. Whereas, as much as we can do to keep roofs over our head, quite often,
absolutely.
And fair play. I don't begrudge anyone earning a good living, but it is an interesting difference, that this side of the pond and that side of the pond, in terms of the economics of theatre, of course.
And I think all that comes down to, I mean, it actually goes back to the first thing that Flick said about working as an ASM to have to get her equity card. Because you don't need to belong to a union in this country anymore, there is no question in my mind that working conditions have changed because you don't need to be a union member. Whereas my 8 years working mostly in Canada, a little bit in the US as well, it's a unionized industry, and it is much better for that, actually, as far as I'm concerned. I know a lot of people would disagree with that, but I think unions make the industry better.
Mm. Yes, I wouldn't disagree with that. I think there is. We always hear those horror stories, though, don't we, about don't cross demarcation lines. And I think there's got to be a somewhere in the middle that's a, probably a happy place.
Yes,
I don't think there's any theatres in the middle of the middle of the Atlantic,
no.
is there?
So, no.
But that's it would just... be ideal if there was. Because this is how did this come about? You, what have you two done together that I haven't? For some reason, Tash, you didn't let me work with you on. What's that about?
So we did a play together. It was a two-hander, so the lovely Flick and a guy called Nick Raggett, who went by Raggett more often than not, was on a show called Sexy Laundry at the Tabard Theatre, which I think has now been rebranded entirely and under new management as Chiswick Playhouse in Turnham Green, with Phoebe Barron as the director. And it was just, it was a new write, and it was an interesting rehearsal period because the show itself is called Sexy Laundry. So there was a lots of doo 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 bow chicka wow wow going on.
for those not on the Zoom call, Tash is now stripping gently in the background.
I'm absolutely not doing that. Although I have to say, the heating guy is here today to bleed through our radiators, and he's got the radiators on, and I'm absolutely roasting in my room. So it might actually have to happen in a sec. But yeah, Flick, please feel free to fill in the gaps. I did a really bad.
No, you didn't. Oh no, she's a Canadian writer, and she's had a lot of success with that play actually all over the world, and it is a very sort of. It's a kind of touching play because it's just about a couple who have sort of not fallen out of love with each other, but got used to each other so much. It's all set in a hotel room, you know, and they've come away from their home to sort of have a weekend, a sort of dirty weekend, as it were. But of course, they end up just talking about their problems and issues with each other and et cetera. But it was very funny, and we had a huge amount to play with, and it was.
Do you want
to
talk about some of the props, Flick, that you had to play with?
Oh gosh, yes, I had. What was that whip called? yes, it was. It was. I had to sort of dress up in a very sort of kind
it was
of
a full whip.
Suggestive, that's right, a suggestive kind of outfit, but I mean very subtle, but I
wait
had
a minute, yeah, wait a minute, hold the you can't have a very suggestive outfit that's very subtle. That's a kind of, that doesn't work.
Well, what I mean is that I was covered up in a sort of little coat.
It was a slip, it was like a jacket.
I had a black
slip underneath.
Lip, and that's right, a little sort of trench coat done with, you know, up at the collar, etc. And
demure sexy
exactly. And I had a sort of bob haircut wig and this whip, and I was trying to tempt him, and he was absolutely terrified.
And the hotel bed was real. We really did have a hotel bed, hotel decor. We had the air diffuser.
Yes,
you know, we had the hotel telephone going on. I remember steaming all the curtains for that hotel room every day, steaming the duvet as though I was a hotelier every day for you. And you just still crease it. It's fine.
Yeah.
That's so annoying, isn't it, yeah. Tash? You've done all that hard work and then the company crease your lovely linens. So it's just, I mean, you know, how awful can that be?
I know. What a nuisance.
So here's a question I was going to ask, because this is something we don't often talk about. You guys as actors are often in that situation where, you know, sexy demure, and you have that funny moment, don't you, on first day of rehearsals when they start showing you the costumes that they're going to put on you and just hang on you. And I always wonder, I think actors get trained to kind of like be involved in that process as building characters, you know, character from the shoes up. But actually in commercial theatre, certainly, you're very much wheeled off. We send you off for a call with the costume and the designer. And I always think you're a bit clothes horsey. I mean, that must be quite an intimate and somewhat annoying relationship sometimes, I'm guessing, if you're putting stuff that you're not quite comfortable with.
Yes, I mean, it absolutely, as always, depends on the personality and character of both people involved, as it were, the actor and the designer and maker of the costumes, or indeed hirer of the costumes. But generally, it's been pretty good. It really has. And the thing about it is that you do obviously have to keep a cheery note, because people can get quite upset about what they're wearing, and I certainly am very particular. But I'm not a pain in the arse, if you know what I mean. I'm just sort of one of those people who just asks for what I need, and I'm pretty honest about it. And I think that's the main thing. You know, you've just got to be able to get on with everybody, and particularly your costume designer.
I mean, it's a team sport, isn't it? In that respect, the number of times I've been on shows where actors haven't had maybe the courage or the confidence, actually is probably the right word, the confidence to just say, you know, look, actually this isn't going to work for me because, you know, the physicality of the thing I'm doing, or, you know, my character wouldn't wear this. And then they never say it at the fitting, and I'm always surprised by that. And it's not until after the first preview, and you know, we're kind of trying to lock things. I hate that phrase, but you know what I mean. That costumes can become this awful, awful issue over and over again, I think, sometimes with actors.
Yes, it can. I remember I was having to play twins with somebody who looked nothing like me, and he had a sort of bob blonde haircut, and they insisted on me wearing this bob blonde wig. And it just looked absolutely ridiculous. But the thing is that you have to get on stage and do it, and then they see it, and then they say, oh, no, that doesn't work.
Yes.
If you start saying, oh, no, I'm not going to wear that because it doesn't work, you've got to see, let the dog see the rabbit, as they say.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to see, you know, you've got to see it.
Well,
and then,
surely people aren't imaginatively impaired in our industry. They have to see it to understand the problem. Can't believe that for a moment.
Well, you know, it does seem to be that way.
It's usually producers in my side.
I think the brilliant thing is that when you get a costume designer who's really, really engaged with the whole production, putting on that costume can sometimes be the most brilliant thing, because you suddenly do think, oh yeah, now I feel complete as the character. Now I feel like this is exactly who I should be. And so I think it works both ways. But I do think you're right, Mark. I think actors do have to be able to say at the initial fitting, I'm just not feeling that this is going to work for me. But I mean, I think that's partly why I became an actor, because people like dressing up, don't they? And part of it is the costume, you know?
Sure.
What's been the most iconic costume you've had to put on, or even a quick change that you just distinctly remember being backstage and you're frantically trying to get to your cue and you've got people surrounding you trying to get that shoe on or doing that button up?
Well, when I first did Les Mis in the West End, and I did it a long time ago, first of all, when Sir Trevor Nunn and people like that were still involved in the production. And I couldn't believe, because I'd never seen it. I've still never seen it. I spent 4 years in it and I've never, ever seen it. Haven't seen the film, haven't seen the show.
It's very good, apparently, John.
So I believe. When I first did Les Mis, and, you know, they were stunning costumes. I mean, they were exquisitely made and incredible wigs and all of those things. But when I've had my initial costume fitting, and then costumes kept coming out, and more costumes kept coming out, and more costumes kept coming out, and I said to the wonderful costume lady Rue, can't remember her last name, which was the costume, the wardrobe mistress on Les Mis for years, I said, "Who are all those costumes for?" She said, "They're all your costumes." I said, "What? All of them? I have to wear all those costumes?" And she said, "Yes." And when we started to get into tech, I mean, I had, in the first half of Les Mis, the first time I did it, I had 22 costume changes. You cannot do that unless you've got incredible dressers and wardrobe people and stage managers watching out to see if you've made that quick change before you're meant to run back on. So I think that was the kind of most interesting set of costumes I ever had. And the kind of hardest cut changes. And before I'd done that show, I'd done a show where I was naked on stage, so I had no costume at all. So I went from the sublime to the ridiculous.
And fair play, that's a rite of passage for an actor, isn't it? That whole naked on stage bit, which I always feel for you guys, because I, you know, that's if you're about portraying real life, sometimes in real life people are nude, but to do it in front of several hundred people for 8 shows a week always seems there's an ask.
I wouldn't do it now. I would do it now, because I was 23 when I did it the first time, and I think it was probably. you know, I think it was probably all right for the audience to look at. I don't think it would be as pleasant for the audience to look at now.
No, I think probably best not.
Thank you for that vote of confidence, Felicity.
No, I'm talking about myself. But yes, when you're young, you can get away with it a bit better.
I tell you what was interesting about the nude show I did, and that our director insisted that the stage management be naked and that he was naked. Because he said, if we're going to have six actors without clothes on, actually, we can't make them uncomfortable. We should all be naked. And so the stage management were naked at points. And what became really interesting was that as the show went on, and it wasn't based in real life at all, it was a piece of nonsense. It did manage to run for six struggling months. but we became very used to seeing our bodies as if they were costumes. So you would brush a bit of fluff off somebody, because like you would off somebody's costume,
yeah.
Because it just became so used to the fact that we were naked. And honestly, after a week, standing backstage without clothes on felt like you were wearing a costume. It did. Yeah. It was weird.
I always see stage management having thousands of pockets, and I just where do you put your pens and your LX tape? Like, I mean, I know there's places you can put them.
My
head just goes. What?
Maybe I should clear that up. They were naked during rehearsals when we were naked. They weren't naked during the actual show running, because, as you say, there are only so many places you can put a pencil.
Absolutely.
And that would have been a very different kind of party, I suppose.
Yes.
That point,
you know?
That's Tash's face was. How long ago did you say that was, though?
How long ago? God, it's about 28 years ago.
The only reason I ask is because I can't imagine something like me and Mark being asked to be doing that now. Do you know what?
You've clearly not played with enough stage managers, Tash, because I have to say, whenever there's nudity in my shows and I've got a new ASM, the first thing I say is, okay, we're to the ASM in all earnestness and seriousness. That day we're rehearsing those nude scenes, we're all naked in solidarity, because everyone's face is exactly what you're doing now on camera. It's like, what? What? But of course, in a work environment, if your boss says to you, this is what we're going to do, in all sincerity, most people go, oh, okay, right. Yeah, sure. No, we're really not going to do it. But, you know, I've been in that situation as a younger ASM. So I got absolutely hazed on that one, doing a show. We're all going to go naked in the rehearsal room. Personally, I wouldn't have had a problem with it, because I figure we are all colleagues together and we're all in it together, you know. But yeah. I agree with John, probably not so much now. The pounds have gone on a bit since then. Flick and John, how do you both know each other then, in terms of your best friends? Does that mean you met on a show, or pre-working on a show, or how do you both know each other?
We
did. Go on, John.
We met on a show. We met on Fiddler on the Roof at the London Palladium.
Oh, it was about 90-something, wasn't it? 94, was it, John?
I think it was 94, 95 or something, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We had a wonderful sort of stint at the Palladium. And then we went on tour, which sometimes it's a bit unusual, isn't it? You go on tour, then into London. But yeah. We went the way round. And we had a very eventful time on tour. It was pretty pretty exciting.
First of all, we were told after we'd done 3 months at the London Palladium that we would have this tour of the Far East. And we went to Eastbourne. That was about as far east as we got, to be honest.
Brilliant. Yeah. A big show like that on tour, I mean, my recollection was, I mean, it's a long time ago, my recollection was it was a big show. And so you weren't doing weekly touring on that, presumably. That was sit-downs for regular periods.
That was sit-downs for like 4 or 5 weeks at a time, yeah.
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 It would have just taken a long time to do the install, I would have thought, if nothing else. So.
What was interesting for that show, I think, from the perspective of stage management as well, is that it was at that point, it was the 30th anniversary production. And so from America, they brought the original sets, and they had the book and the Bible from the original production. So everything was done, acting, stage management, everything was done by numbers.
Yeah,
exactly as it had been done 30 years ago. And of course, sets that were 30 years old at that point were also tricky for stage management to work with at some points, because the technology had changed already by the time we got to do it. So I think the stage management didn't always have the easiest job touring that show, because some of it was also pretty much held together with, you know, elastoplast and staples.
And I mean, I think, you know, I think all shows are built because they're built factory fresh as we're going to do this show and it's going to last X amount of time. But then, of course, it doesn't quite recoup. So we're going to put it out again. And then we're going to put it out again. And all of a sudden, this thing that's meant to have a limited lifespan of 6 months is now 6 years down the line.
Yes.
And you are, as you say, you're holding it together with gaffer tape and spit by the end, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Topple didn't do the tour, though, did he? He only did town. He wouldn't have been on the road.
No, he did the tour.
He did do the tour.
Goodness me. Wow. And I've got to ask, what characters were you both playing in Fiddler?
Well,
I can't remember. I think I played second Russian from the left. I think I did have it. I had my character's name was Sasha, but I understudied Fiedka, who was one of the lovers, the young lovers.
Yes.
And for various reasons, I pretty much played that for about half the entire production, actually. So I was very lucky in that regard. Not very lucky for the actor who had been playing it, who had a series of unfortunate events, which meant that he didn't get to play it. But I did get to do that a lot. Which was
and of course, that's great, because all that extra money you play when you step in.
Well, then, of course, it was extra money, wasn't it? Now, you know, it's like £12.50 and a hearty handshake. But then it was.
Now, I'm going to word this so it doesn't sound rude. There is a thing that happens, I think, with stage management. On a Saturday night on the last show, when you're in the green room and you're saying to each other, so, you know, what are you doing after this? And often stage managers will go, oh, I'm starting another show on Monday, or I've got a week off, I'm going on holiday, and then I'm starting another show. And I always feel a bit guilty about this, because often for actors, you've had that nice 4-6 months contract, and there is nothing to go on to. And part of me knows that sometimes there's a little bit of, it's a bit uncomfortable, but also you kind of feel a little smug sometimes. I don't, but I know some people get a little smug about the fact that consistently stage managers work more often than actors do, it's fair to say. In the strange times in which we find ourselves, it strikes me you guys are actually probably more in work than we're ever likely to be. Would that be fair? Because I think there's a lot of potential opportunities now with voiceovers and audiobooks and Zoom performances, that all of a sudden we've just become completely surplus to the process. Is that fair? Are you finding that yourselves, or you've got in your extended acting circles? Are people busy?
Yes. I mean, because I do voiceovers anyway. I've always done them, you know, for the, well, I don't know, last sort of 15, 20 years. And so I've had a slight hiatus since you know, this has happened. But I'm you know, updating equipment and all sorts of things, and getting, I've got a voiceover to do after this for the NHS, actually, and for the RAF. They're charities that help raise money for both those places. And I'm really delighted to do them. And obviously, you can do audiobooks quite easily, as long as you've got the right studio. And it is a great part of you know, what I do anyway. I'm very, you know, very much enjoying that feeling of being able to have that option.
And hopefully that's more than keeping the wolf from the door, I would have thought.
Well, it helps, you know. It does help. And but a lot of avenues, you know, are a bit blocked. So, you know, it's good to be proactive and trying to find other ways of maybe using the studio. I don't know quite yet, but I am sort of thinking along those lines much more. But obviously,
is that the same for you as well, John? Or have you're a recording at home person as well?
I'm sort of a recording at home person. I have done voiceovers. I don't do anything like Miss Duncan does, because she is supremely talented at voiceovers. Anyone that's listening to this, she's a marvelous voiceover artist. I have a company that I'm part of as well, called the West Enders, which is a group of performers who met 20 years ago, the first time we did Les Mis. And we produce musical theatre shows around the world, actually. There are six singers, and we often have a band of anywhere between 3 people and 25 people, depending on the venue we're using. obviously for us, we had a very healthy slate of work of concerts this year, which all completely have disappeared. So what we are doing in common with lots of other people, we've been doing a lot of digital content. We started a kind of occasional web series called Doctor Theatre, where we've had people from the group and also people we've invited who've got some connection to us to do whatever they want to do. And we put them together into these little kind of webisodes, which have been really successful, actually. We're making sure that all the albums we've recorded are up on iTunes and all those kind of things, that people can still access our music if they want to listen to it.
Oh,
and we are considering, I think the thing that is great about putting out that digital content is, yes, it's keeping people interested in the art, etc. But at some point, depending on when theatre starts to work again, and I personally do not see that before the spring of 2021. That is my opinion, and I think we maybe need to be quite realistic about that.
Yes, yes, I agree, yeah.
But I think if digital content is going to become very important in the next few months, there also has to be a way, sadly, of monetizing it. Because although it's wonderful that people can put things out without wanting to sound like a money-grabbing actor, this is what people do to pay their mortgages, have their kids, put food on the table. You know, and I think in terms of if we're going to find a new way to create experiences, performance experiences, that's when people like stage managers will hopefully come back into being useful to us. Because, for example, if the West Enders decided to do a live streamed concert, which we are looking into now, we will unquestionably need stage managers to help plot it, run it.
Yeah.
You know, do all those kind of things. And I hope that we all can find a way to sort of work together a little bit on those kind of projects so that we all share what very small pie there is.
Yep, I think it's really interesting. I have really mixed views about the amount of online content that's coming out. It felt very much to begin with like a real knee-jerk reaction. We had to do something. And, you know, one man, two governors, everybody tuned into it. And I've kind of stopped watching online content now because it both impresses me that our industry is reacting, but it puts my teeth on edge that we're thinking it's a real substitute. I can't think of a good analogy. It's like asking vampires to be vegetarians. You're still going to eat, but you're not going to be satisfied at the end of the meal. Folks, listen, this is all fantastic, and we're really grateful to you for giving up your time and just coming. We said at the beginning, no fixed agenda on this. It's just kind of nice to, as we've all got the time and the technology to chat with each other, we're just kind of finding folk to chat to, and as with you guys today, have very interesting conversations that are either anecdotes or pearls of wisdom or just a bit of a giggle, really. And it's just been lovely to have a bit of a giggle with two lovely actors.
Well, thank you again. It's been really, really nice to talk to both of you.
Really nice.
It's been utterly boring to talk to you, Flick, because I talk to you like 3 times a day anyway. So
yeah, we meet for cocktails every evening on the phone, actually, not on Zoom.
Yeah.
Oh, that is very civilized, actually.
It is.
Yeah.
It's not civilized by about 7 o'clock, and we've both drunk a bottle of wine. But to begin with, it's kind of nice.
Terrific.
Take care.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.